So we're going to do part one of looking at Moses. Technically, next week we're going to look at the children of Israel and what God did for them, events surrounding the Exodus. But we get to look at the beginning of Moses' life and what a simple act of faith, I don't think it was simple, it would have been scary to me, by his parents. How God was able to provide everything that was needed because God had a plan for Moses' life. And we get to the title of our study tonight is, By Faith, Moses Made a Choice. I think my personal opinion is, besides Jesus himself, Moses made, hands down, the biggest choice of anybody in the Bible to refuse one thing in order to embrace another thing. I mean, Jesus left glory of heaven as the Son of God and came down to be spit on and cursed at and live in a blue-collar town and be despised and rejected. Moses made a very, very similar choice. And we're going to look at tonight how he was able to do that, how he was able to obey. Moses certainly was not perfect like any of the people in this. Moses had some failures in his life. If you were going to break Moses' life down into three parts, it does break down nicely into three 40-year periods. And one of my favorite teachers said, here's what Moses learned in his life, three periods. Age 1 through 40, Moses learned that he was something special. Age 40 to age 80, Moses learned that he was nothing special. And for the rest of his life, age 80 onward, he learned that God can take nothing special and do something special. So it just lays itself out nicely. I learned things I never knew. I have in my notes here in big letters so I won't forget it. Read chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 first. The reason we do that every time is that chapter 12 tells us why chapter 11 was written. It tells us why these particular people are listed for us, not all of the failures of their life, but the things that they did in faith, the lengths they were willing to go to. There's really no separating faith and obedience. You can't really have one without the other. And so Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, and I'm going to read it from the Amplified Bible just because it's fat. So this is the end. This is what the writer of Hebrews is saying at the end of the chapter that we're going to run out of letters in the alphabet by the time we get finished with it. This is part F tonight. Therefore, then, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses who have borne testimony to the truth, let us strip off and throw aside every encumbrance, every unnecessary weight, and the sin which so readily and cleverly clings to and entangles us, and let us run with patient endurance and steady and active persistence the appointed course of the race that is set before us, looking away from all that will distract unto Jesus. That's a very important verb, to look away from something in order to look at something else. And we're going to see not the same verb, but the verb with the exact same meaning in our passage tonight that explains how Moses was able to make the choice that he made. Because he successfully looked away from one thing and look towards another thing, and it helped him to run his race. Let me read these five verses, and then I'm going to read you Exodus chapter 1 and 2, so that we see the story as it unfolds. I also learned some things that I found some great Jewish resources. You know, you want to read about Moses, Hebrew commentaries are really good for that, because he's their hero. But I learned some things that I never knew. For instance, does anybody know what Moses' real name was? Moses is not his real name. That's the Egyptian name that Pharaoh's daughter gave him. And she did that when he was 12 years old. So for 12 years, he had another name that was given to him by his father. So I'll tell you what Hebrew tradition says. The answer to that question is we don't know for sure. But the oldest Jewish tradition, and nobody has more accurate oral tradition than the Jews of any people on earth. I'll tell you what his given name most probably was. So you've already learned something you didn't know, right? Hebrews chapter 11, verses 23:20-27. Boy, the Amplified Bible, once again, is so fat, and I will use it extensively tonight, but I'm just going to read this out of my New King James. By faith, and of course, once again, the sentence structure is really awkward in the New King James, so I'm going to read it the way the sentence structure should be. By faith, Moses was hidden 3 months by his parents when he was born because they saw that he was a beautiful child. The word special might be a better word there. He was a beautiful child, special child. And by faith, that should be parenthesized, by faith they were not afraid of the king's command. So that's his parents. That's the start he got off to. Now, verse 24, you skip ahead 40 years. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, and Acts chapter 7 tells us it was at age 40, when he became of age, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing instead to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Circle the word enjoy. Circle the word choosing. They're important words. Esteeming the reproach of Messiah, which is what Christ means, the reproach of Messiah greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, because he looked to the reward. That's the same word that we saw, that I just read to you. Not the same word. It's a word with the same meaning. Meaning to look away from one thing to look to another thing. So the Amplified Bible says he looked forward and away to the reward. That was how he was able to make this value judgment. And now we jump 40 years again farther ahead into Moses' life. In verse 27, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, because he endured as seeing him who is invisible, is one word in Greek, the invisible one. So he endured, he was able to endure as seeing the invisible one. We'll talk about all this tonight. There's some fabulous thing in here. By the way, Moses left Egypt twice. The first time he left Egypt, he left in fear. So verse 27, he forsook Egypt, and that word forsook means once and for all. He wasn't coming back. And it says he was not fearing the wrath of the king, so that tells us that verse 27 is talking about the second time that he left Egypt, and the second time he left Egypt, he took 2.5 million people with him. Okay, so let's look at this. Let me read you the events surrounding the birth of Moses. There are some linguistic things that make it easier to understand. I wouldn't have known it had I not looked in Exodus and looked up the Hebrew words. Even the Greek text here in Hebrews 11 didn't help me as much to understand what it was saying. We stopped, remember last time, we stopped with Joseph. So we're going to pick up where we left off last time. In time, Exodus 1 verse 6, in time, Joseph and all of his brothers died, ending that entire generation. But their descendants, the Israelites, had many children and grandchildren. In fact, they multiplied so greatly that they became extremely powerful and filled the land. Eventually, a new king came to power in Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph or what he'd done. And he said to his people, that is his advisors, look, the people of Israel now outnumber us, and are stronger than we are. We have to make a plan to keep them from growing even more. If we don't, if war breaks out, they might join our enemies and fight against us, and then they'll escape. So the Egyptians made the Israelites their slaves. They appointed brutal slave drivers over them, hoping to wear them down with crushing labor. They forced them to build the cities of Pithom and Ramses as supply centers for the king. By the way, all those fabulous monuments that you see in Israel, it was in Egypt, it was Israelites that built them. Slave labor. But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more the Israelites multiplied and spread, and the more alarmed the Egyptians became. And so the Egyptians worked the people of Israel without mercy. They made their lives bitter, forcing them to mix mortar and make bricks and do all the work in the fields, and they were ruthless in their demands. Then Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, gave this order to Hebrew midwives, Shipra and Puah. Here's what he said. When you help the Hebrew women as they give birth, watch as they deliver, and if the baby is a boy, kill him. And if it's a girl, let her live. You can obviously see the population control that he was after. But because the midwives feared God, they refused to obey the king's orders, and they allowed the boys to live too. It would have taken a while for Pharaoh to figure out that his orders weren't being followed. And when he did, he called for the midwives. Verse 18, I think. The numbers are so small, I can't read it. And he said, why have you done this? Why have you allowed the boys to live? And the Hebrew women, this is their answer. The midwife said, the Hebrew women aren't like Egyptian women. They're more vigorous. They have their babies so quickly that we can't get there in time. I talked to some guy that said, because God's going to bless the midwives for what they did, but this person said, how could God bless somebody who lied? And I'm going to say, well, how do you know that was a lie? Could have been absolutely true. So don't know. God was good to the midwives, and the Israelites continued to multiply, growing more and more powerful. And because the midwives feared God, God gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all of his people. This is where we're coming up on Moses' story. Throw every newborn Hebrew boy. He gave this order to all of his people. So now it's not just in the hands of the Hebrew midwives. Now it's every Egyptian. Throw every newborn Hebrew boy into the Nile River, but you can let the girls live. Chapter 2 of Exodus. About this time, a man and woman from the tribe of Levi got married. I'll give you their names if you're interested. Amram, A-M-R-A-M, that's his dad. Jochebed, which is spelled J-O-C-H-E-B-E-D, that's his mom. Jochebed and Amram from the tribe of Levi, they got married. The women became pregnant and gave birth to a son. Now here's the phrase that the New Testament copies, but I think they've missed the significance of some of the Hebrew words in the English translation. It says, she saw that he was a special baby and kept him hidden for 3 months. But the word saw means to discern, not just to see visibly. The Hebrew word means to perceive something and to discern something. And the word special, one of its primary meanings is beautiful, but the other one is favored by God. So there's a lot more that makes sense to this story if you read it in Exodus, that she discerned that the baby was favored by God. And so she hid him for 3 months, basically she hid him until she couldn't get away with it anymore. When she could no longer hide him, she got a basket made of papyrus reeds, waterproofed it with tar and pitch, and she put the baby in the basket, laid it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile River. And the baby's sister, that's Miriam, who's 10 years old at this time, Moses also had an older brother who was 8 years old named Aaron. So the baby's sister, Miriam, she's my hero in this story. she stood at a distance watching to see what would happen to him. So she's kind of standing off to the side. And think of the act of faith that it had to be for Jochebed to take this baby that she believes she's discerned in that 3 months that she has hidden him, that God has plans for him, that he's favored by God, and she's entrusting him to God. And when you look at the way things unfolded, that just defies the statistical odds of it being an accident or a coincidence. So the baby's left floating in the reed basket. And soon Pharaoh's daughter came down to bathe in the river, and her attendants walked along the riverbank. When the princess saw the basket among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it for her. And when the princess opened it, she saw the baby. The little boy was crying, and she felt sorry for him. This must be one of the Hebrew children, she said. Now just listen, just follow this line of reasoning. Pharaoh, who is worshipped as God, whose word is law, whose word must be obeyed, has decreed that every Egyptian, if they find a newborn Hebrew baby, is to kill it. There's only one person in all of the kingdom who's not bound by that law, and that's Pharaoh's daughter, and she's the one that finds the baby. So here's the scene. The baby cries. She feels sorry for him. She knows he's a Hebrew baby. And here's 10-year-old Miriam, our hero, and she's just a little ways away, and she watches what happened, and what a brave girl. Then the baby's sister approached the princess. Should I go and find one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? She asked. I put a big smiley face next to that. And I thought, how brave does a 10-year-old girl have to be to talk to the princess of Egypt and make that suggestion? But look what happened. And the princess replied, yes, please do. And so the girl went and called Jochebed, the baby's mother. The princess told the baby's mother, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you for your help. And so the woman took her baby home and nursed him. God is amazing. Here's the only person in all of Egypt who could possibly defy the order of Pharaoh, and she's paying Moses' mother to take care of Moses. So she took him home. Remember, he's just 3 months old right now. Now, here's another thing that I didn't know until I looked at the Hebrew words and I read a couple of Hebrew commentaries. Verse 10 says, later, when the boy grew older, his mother brought him back to Pharaoh's daughter, who adopted him as her own son. The princess named him Moses. So that was not his Hebrew name. That was an Egyptian name. And it means, she said, she named him Moses because she explained, I lifted him out of the water. The Hebrew pronunciation of that Egyptian name is Moshe. M-O-S-H-E-H. And if you've been to Shiroshim there in Jerusalem, one of the guys that owns it is a rabbi named Moshe. And his brother's name is Dov. An Egyptian name. So, how old was Moses? I Googled this question because I was really curious. Every Christian commentary that even addressed it, I wanted to know, how long did Jochebed have her son in her home to raise him before she took him back? When it says she nursed him, that just means that right then, at 3 months old, she took him home and nursed him. The language in verse 10 where it says, later when the boy grew older, then she took him to the palace. So how old was he? The only commentaries I read, the Christian commentaries I read that addressed it, said he was 3 or 4 years old. All of the Jewish commentaries I read, every one of them, said the text does not say, but the language, the words that are used, the word for grew and the word for son and the word for child, means that he had to be at least 12 years old. when he went to the palace. So he goes to the palace. His mom and his dad and his family have had 12 years to teach him about the God of Israel. Doesn't seem like much time, does it? Those of you that had your child for 12 years and you cast them off into the big bad world and you hope, man, I hope what I planted in their hearts in those 12 years is enough to get them through. Well, where did Moses go after this? He went to the house of the most powerful ruler on the face of the earth. Every Jewish commentary I read said that by the time Moses was 18, so that would have been 6 years after being in Pharaoh's house, if he got there when he was 12, by 18, he was the heir apparent of the throne of Egypt. Acts chapter 10 says, or chapter 7 says, he excelled in the culture and the education of Egypt. No more, there could not be possibly a more polar extreme opposite culture from God-fearing Jewish slaves than to all of a sudden be thrown in the house of the most powerful man on the face of the earth in Egypt. Egypt had a completely different morality in many ways than the Jewish people did. So it's every parent's worst nightmare. You have your kid for 12 years old, for 12 years, you hope you do your best to teach him about God, and then he's thrown into a place where he can have anything he wants. He's surrounded by amoral people. He's treated as if he actually wound up, had he not turned down the opportunity, he would have been the most powerful man on the face of the earth. Every temptation that you could possibly imagine. And that's why verse 24 is so fabulous. Because when he got to be 40 years old, he made a choice. And it took till he was 40 years old, but finally those 12 years of godly teaching kicked in, and he made the right choice. I find that thrilling. So what was Moses' real name? Jewish tradition, from as far back as anybody's ever talked about it, so we're talking several thousand years, Jewish tradition has said that Amram, his father, named him Tov, T-O-V, which means good. So, is that true? Don't know. If it is true, that was his real name. Moses is just our effort to understand the Egyptian name. I've read some Egyptian scholars that had all kinds of, because there were, you know, several of the pharaohs were given different names by successive dynasties. Joseph had an Egyptian name. And once you know his Egyptian name, it's easy to find him in Egyptian history, although he's not mentioned as much as some of the other rulers in ancient Egypt. So here's Moses, mother and father. He's born. They know the law. I think the wording in verse 23 is really important. The reason that they were not afraid, I love the Amplified Bible for that phrase, they were not afraid of the king's command. They were not overawed and terrified by the king's command. Why? Well, it was by faith. If you diagram this sentence, the by faith at the beginning of it talks about the reason why they hid him. They did recognize, they discerned that he was a favored child of God. So their faith was that God would protect him because God had his hand on him. He was marked by God. That's also what that Hebrew word means that's translated beautiful or goodly, the old King James says. But it was also by faith that they were not afraid of God's command. They knew that if God had his hand on Moses, God was going to protect him. And they got to watch it unfold. But can you imagine what a turnaround? You're literally turning loose your newborn baby and pushing him out into the River Nile. I don't know many parents that love their child that would have that much faith. To me, that's as scary as what Abraham did. Simply because they believed he was favored by God, that God had a plan, and they were willing to trust God. And for the same reason, they weren't afraid of the most powerful man on the earth, the command that he gave. And you watch that sequence unfold and you think, it could have gone so many different ways, couldn't it? But God did have a plan. So here's Moses. We're going to just call him that because that's the name we know him by. If the Hebrew scholars are correct, and I'm going to believe them because everybody's guessing, but I think there's linguistic evidence that he had to be at least 12. But if he was 3 or 4, if they only had 3 or 4 years, still it's an even bigger miracle. But it shows the value, doesn't it, of telling children the truth about who God is. Because those few years of telling Moses about the God of Israel and the promised Messiah, we're going to see later that part of his decision to identify with God's people and to refuse all that he had in Egypt was because he looked to the promise that was ahead of Messiah. And he considered that promise to be more valuable than all of the riches in Egypt. And of course, isn't that the theme of the book of Hebrews? That it's worth everything that you and every person that ridicules you and abuses you, it's worth all of their scorn to embrace the promised one. And that's the message to the people who received this letter. But isn't it a wonderful message that the power of the truth, a few years of telling the truth, and then what Moses had as in the house of Pharaoh, our brains cannot calculate it. There's no person alive today that has the wealth and the power that Pharaoh had, and it was all Moses's at his disposal. Later on, when it talks about he decided to choose affliction of the people of God instead of enjoying the pleasures of sin, the language indicates, as what you had to circle that word, that Moses had enjoyed the pleasures of sin. And when it says he esteemed, when he made his choice, it's a calculated choice. It means he experienced everything that Egypt had to offer, and by the time he was 40 years old, weighing that and comparing that with a few lessons he'd had homeschooled by his mom and dad, who were slaves, who had nothing to offer him. He goes from that to having everything at his disposal. No one would have questioned any of his behavior. And at 40 years old, he chose to go the right way. If that doesn't give you chills, if that doesn't encourage you, then you're dead. It just means there's power in the truth. And that the lies don't necessarily have the power to drown it out. I've got lots of friends that are being hurt really bad by their adult children right now. I mean, their hearts are being ripped. You look at their faces and they can't even speak. It just is killing them. And every one of them feels like the promise that says if you train up a child in the way that he should go, when he's old, he won't depart from it. Every one of them are wondering whether that's even a lie or the truth. But the thing I always tell them, I take them to this passage, and I say, for number one, your child's not old yet. So, I mean, Moses at age 40 wasn't considered old. The Jewish people don't consider a man to be mature until he hits 50. So he was not really fully developed. When it talked about of age, 40, Acts chapter 7 tells us that Moses was 40. So calc it out. How many decades did he have of unbridled, whatever he wanted, self-indulgence, power? Josephus tells us that Moses was the commander of Pharaoh's army, the most powerful army on the face of the earth. So he had unlimited power. He's heir to the throne. He could, you know, have any woman he wanted. He could, no one was going to question any of his behavior. And after decades of that, he calced it all out and decided, you know, every time you make a choice, you refuse something. So when we're talking about the choice that Moses made in verse 24, it says, by faith, Moses. First part of the choice he made was he refused the life that was there for him in Egypt. You can't make a choice without refusing something. I see Christians try to do it. People that say they're Christians, they want to live half in the world and half with God, and there's pleasures in the world that they want, and they think that they can hold on to both of them, but you can't. It's not possible. Jesus said you can't have two, you can't serve two masters. You could have two masters, but you can't serve both of them. So Moses, 40 years old. I just think every homeschooling mom should be really encouraged with this, because nobody has ever had to face the kind of temptation that Moses did, coming from the kind of background that he did. But the first choice that he made was he was going to refuse to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. All the privileges that went along with it. Choosing instead, verse 25, to suffer affliction with the people of God. I looked that word affliction up. It doesn't mean that people call you names. The Amplified Bible nails it when it says, let's see if I can find it in here. Verse 25. Share the oppression, suffer the hardships, bear the shame of the people of God. So, in making the choice, he refused one thing, and he embraced another thing. You always do when you make a choice. This was a costly choice. This was a choice that had consequences. Remember what we said a couple of weeks ago? Faith means obedience despite the consequences. I'm always nervous when I hear people try to tell me that they trust in God and yet they don't want to obey Him, especially if they know that it's going to be costly, because you can't separate those two. Two parts to the consequences of what it cost Moses to refuse his position in Egypt. And one was that he had to separate himself from the culture that he lived in for most of his life. And he wasn't just a small frog in a big pond. It was obvious when he made his choice. Do you think any of his friends, any of the people that knew him all those decades in the household of Egypt, do you think any of them thought he was nuts? I'll bet you any of them did. I know some of you would, just when you made the choice to follow Jesus, every one of your friends said you're crazy. I have a friend whose father is a billionaire. If I mentioned his name, you'd know who he was. You'd recognize his name. He's an actor. And when my friend gave his life to Jesus, his father disowned him and disinherited him, cut him off completely. And he went from, you know, having everything in his life, story very similar to Moses. And he moved, went to Calvary Chapel during the Jesus movement when I was there, and he lived in a corrugated metal shack in a ravine on the outskirts of Laguna Beach. And all he wanted to do was talk about how happy he was that he had Jesus. It breaks my heart when I see people that are drawn to the world. It means they do not understand the value. First of all, they're deceived by the world, and second is they don't understand the value of what Jesus offers. So part one of the consequences of Moses choosing instead to be with the people of God is that part one was that he separated himself from the people that he'd spent most of the best part of his life with. And the second part of was just as bad, but the other side of the coin was he then identified with God's people. Who were what? They were slaves. They were hated. They were despised. They were abused. So it's so similar to what Jesus did, isn't it? In the same magnitude, not the same magnitude of a choice, but of all the people in the Bible, Moses made the most costly choice next to Jesus of anybody I can imagine. But he chose instead, separating himself from his former life and identify with the people of God rather than enjoying the pleasures of sin. Enjoy the pleasures is one word. But it's in a verb tense. I had to look it up. I did that this morning because I wondered. Because the language to me seemed to say that when Moses was choosing to identify with God's people rather than enjoy the pleasures, it made to me it sounded like he had been enjoying the pleasures of sin. And it is a verb tense that speaks of repeated action. Present infinitive active, I believe. So it's like saying he chose instead to identify himself with the people of God rather than continuing to enjoy the pleasures of sin. I want to talk about that for a while. I grew up in a church that lied to me about the pleasures of sin. I grew up in a very legalistic church, and the story they told, because they were scared to death we were all going to go hog wild, they told us when we were kids, is that sin was icky and sin was horrible and you don't want to go there. And they did not tell us that sin was pleasurable. And when we found out how much pleasure there was in sin, we didn't believe any of the other stuff they told us about it. The Bible warns us about sin because the Bible knows that sin is pleasurable. I invented a phrase yesterday. I'll pass it on to you. After I die, maybe I'll get royalties from it. Sin is yummy rat poison. The Bible does not warn us about eating carpet tacks because I'll take one bite of a handful of carpet tacks, and I know I don't want to do that. It does warn me about sin, because the Bible knows that sin is going to appeal to my flesh, but it is poison. I've had lots of dealings with young people that don't believe that. They just see that sin is pleasurable, and if it feels this good, how could it possibly be wrong? And so the example that I use when, I tell them that they need why the Bible warns them against sin. As I said, if that yummy thing that you had sprinkled on top of your ice cream every time you had ice cream that tastes so fabulous, if somebody told you that was rat poison and it would kill you, would you stop? And the answer is no, you wouldn't, unless you believed them. It doesn't taste like rat poison. But see, sin doesn't taste like what it's doing to you. It tastes good. I heard one of my favorite pastors, and pastors quite a large church, addressing people in his church that they, the guys come, one of my church was big. I had guys that came because we had the cutest girls in town. A lot of servicemen showed up because it was a good way to find a cute girl. So this guy said, it's on tape, he said, look, if what you want, you're here at church Sunday night, if what you want is the pleasures of sin, you're wasting your time in church. It's not on our menu. And if you want that, if that's what you want, then don't be a weenie sinner and come to church. Go out and go hog wild. Sin like a man. Sin with all your heart. Sin until you're sick of it. And then when you learn and you're broken, and you know you need forgiveness, and you want to give yourself fully to God, we'll still be here, and you will be welcome with open arms. And I thought that was brilliant. Moses had enough experience to understand. He had the best the world could offer. But he understood, number one, it was fleeting, temporary pleasure. And the thing about sin is that it is lethal. And that's why God hates it. It's odd. I'm continually running in, since I've been here, a pastor here, running into people who say they're Christians, whose idea of love is that if you love me, you won't tell me that what I'm doing is wrong. And then when I take them to what God's word says, they don't believe it. And I say, well, that isn't the God that I believe in. But see, love compels you to warn somebody if they're doing something that's destructive. So, sin is pleasurable. And you're not doing anybody a favor if you try to tell them otherwise. It is pleasurable. That's why we're warned. But the truth about sin is that at first it separates from God, and it destroys, and it kills. And it's deceitful, like yummy rat poison, because it doesn't taste like it's killing you. And by the time it's killed you, it's too late. You've done the damage. It's not too late to be forgiven, but the damage is done. So Moses made the value judgment based on just a few years of hearing the truth. And I love the verse 26. I love the first word in verse 26, the word esteeming. It's an accountant's word. To esteem, this word means to reckon something or to account something. The one commentary I read said it is a calculated and thoughtful decision. Picture a spreadsheet analysis. We have laid everything all out, and you've said, okay, if we do this venture over here, it's going to cost X number of dollars. We're going to get this much gain. And you look at all the figures, and you look at the bottom line, and then you look at this one over here, and you say, okay, now if we do this, it's going to be this much return. It's going to cost this much. And the risk analysis and everything, and you look at those bottom line figures, and you make a choice based on that. That's what is all wrapped up in this Greek word. The decision that Moses made, that the reproach of Messiah was greater riches than all of the treasures of Egypt, was not something that happened easily or quickly. It was calculated, it was thoughtful, it was based on experiencing the pleasures of sin. Some of us have made that same decision. Some people, I don't understand. I mean, I understand the attraction of sin to my flesh, but I don't want to go back there. Not when your choice is that you can be with Jesus and you can have all that God offers. At a critical point in my life, in my 20s, when I was just getting off the ground as a studio musician in Hollywood, I had a great career ahead of me. I was making the best money I've ever made, triple union scale, as a studio musician. Started doing orchestrations and, you know, basically was living my dream. It was right then that I started going to Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa. I remember a real critical point in my life, Pastor Chuck teaching on this passage of Scripture. And he talked about Moses making that calculated decision that the reproach of Messiah was greater riches than all the treasures of Egypt. And here's what Pastor Chuck said. It stuck in my head. I've never forgotten it. He said, the worst that God has to offer is still better than the best that the world has to offer. And he said, I have to tell you, the reproach of being a Christian is the worst that God has to offer. People who used to think you were smart are going to think you're a brainless idiot. They're going to think you have no sense, that you're living in some fantasy world. And he said, and if that hurts, that reproach of people who don't understand. But he said, that's the worst that God has to offer. Moses calculated it out that was still better than all the treasures of Egypt. No contest. Now, that was his calculated decision. But I love that in verse 26, it tells us why he could do that, why he could make that calculated decision. And it's an important one. It says, because he looked to the reward. The Greek word means to look forward and away. It's like that one in chapter 12, verse 2, that talks about taking your eyes off of one thing in order to look at another thing. So the way he was able to make that calculated decision is that he looked away from this and he looked down the road. And I got to talk about this. I'll never forget that message from Pastor Chuck because it changed my life. I decided at that point that whatever it cost me, I was going to live my life for Jesus. I have a lot of people that I knew thought I was wasting my talents. Many of them still do. I know I could have made a lot more money. But when you are looking in the right place, it becomes no contest. Psalm 73, written by Asaph, another musician like David who wrote Psalm 37. They're easy to remember because 37 and 73 are, you know, dyslexic of each other. But both of those psalms say the same thing. Both of those psalms say, you know, I looked at the trouble I was having trying to be godly. I looked at the people who don't care what God thinks. They don't seem to have any troubles at all. And I started wondering, is this worth it? Am I wasting my energies? In Psalm 73, Asaph said, yeah, now I know. He said, when I was thinking that way, I was thinking like just a dumb animal. But he said, when I came into the sanctuary of the Lord, and I looked at the end of the road the ungodly were walking down, and I looked at the end of the road that I was walking down, I realized I don't want to go down that road. No matter what it looks like now, I'm looking at the end of that road, and I say, no, I don't want to go there. But looking down the road of the godly, yeah, it's bumpy, and it's difficult for part of it. But if you look at the end of it, and that's exactly what the writer of Hebrews says enabled Moses to make the calculated choice that he did. He couldn't just look at the facts here. He wasn't saying, I'll trade being a bazillionaire with unlimited power for being a slave in Egypt. It wasn't about that. It was about all the promises that God made to those people. First of all, that they weren't going to stay slaves in Egypt, that they had their own land, that all of the nations of the earth were going to be blessed by Messiah that was coming out of that lineage. So Moses made a calculated choice based on something he learned homeschooled by his mom and perhaps his older sister that enabled him to fix his eyes down the road. And that's what enabled him to make the right calculated choice. Remember in verse 1 of chapter 11, it says that faith is the conviction of things that are not seen yet. So Moses is another example of that. And you can see the obvious application of this to the readers of Hebrews and to us. Because they made a calculated choice to believe in Messiah, and it cost them everything. Some of them, it cost them their business. Some of them, their families disowned them. They were objects of scorn. It was even worse because they were considered to have abandoned God by leaving Judaism to believe in Jesus as their Messiah. They were paying a heavy price. And all the way through the whole book of Hebrews, he's saying, look, you guys, don't give that up because you made the right choice. And you're not alone. Other people have made that same choice. And that's what all of chapter 11 is about, is other people that decided that what they were going to believe what God said and choose and obey based on what God said, no matter what it cost them. And there's just not a lot of that going around. Verse 27. I think I've got enough time to do this. This is great. I'm loving this. So we jump 40 years ahead now. Moses has made his choice. When he made the choice and he decided to go to cast his lot with his own people, here's a guy that's raised, he's a man of power. He's a man of influence. And the first thing that happens when he goes down to the, you know, the area there in Goshen or wherever it was at this time that the Israelites were, he saw an Egyptian harassing an Israelite, and he came to his rescue and he killed the Egyptian. And he buried him. And he continues on, and the next day, he sees two Israelites fighting. This is Exodus chapter 2, 3, and 4. And he sees two Israelites fighting, and he tries to break up the fight and says, hey, you guys, you're brothers. You shouldn't be fighting. And he's thinking he's going to be welcomed. Here he's given all this up, and now he's going to be welcomed by his own people. And the first thing they looked was, well, who in the world put you in charge? And if we don't obey what you say, are you going to kill us like you did the Egyptian yesterday? And he panicked. His first effort, when he thought he's qualified and he's prepared and he makes the calculated choice, his first effort to deliver his people just gets everybody mad at him. His face is on wanted posters in Egypt. His face is on wanted posters in Israeli post offices, and he runs for it. And he runs out into the, what euphemistically the King James Bible calls the backside of the desert. And when I was a kid, a junior high kid in Sunday school, I couldn't help but laugh hearing about the backside of the desert. Like, what does that look like? Doesn't sound pleasant, does it? So he goes out there and he winds and he lives the next 40 years in obscurity, keeping sheep. And they're not even his sheep. They're somebody else's sheep. So how far can you go? His own people don't want to welcome him. He goes out in the wilderness. 40 years after he thought he was ready. Of course, when he thought he was ready, he wasn't ready. 40 years later, God comes to him. And you know the burning bush story, of which I find just hilarious. Then in the midst of an ordinary day, he sees in the distance a burning bush and he says, wow, that's interesting. I think I'll go over there and take a look at it. And he gets over there and the first thing he notices is that it's not an ordinary burning bush because it's not being consumed. And the second thing he notices is it's not an ordinary burning bush because it knows his name. Because the bush says, Moses, Moses, that got his attention. And then he realizes it's God, and God says, okay, you know when you thought you were ready? You weren't ready. Now you are ready. And he says, no, sorry, I'm not. I'm not going to try to deliver anybody. You got the wrong guy. Find somebody else. And he argues with the bush. Because he knows that it's God. Isn't it interesting that for what God had for him to do, when he thought he was ready, he was not. And when he knew he was nothing, then he was ready. The world has it so backwards. So 40 years later, God talks him into, and it was elaborate and it was not without argument, that God talked him into going back and said, look, I am going to use you to deliver my people. I misspoke on Sunday when I talked about Jesus saying, I am. And I said, God told Moses to tell Pharaoh that was his name. No, God told Moses to tell the Israelites that that was his name. When Moses came to Pharaoh, he just said, the God of Israel says, let my people go. And Pharaoh said, I don't know about your stinking God, and why do I have to do what he says? I'm God. So I'm sorry. At least I have a chance to correct it for a few people that hear this. God sends him back. You know the whole story with all the plagues and everything. The second time that he leaves Egypt with all of God's people behind him, he didn't leave it in fear. And I love the language, and the Amplified Bible nails it really well. Let me read verse 27. Motivated by faith, he left Egypt behind him, being unawed and undismayed by the wrath of the king. And he never flinched, but held staunchly to his purpose and endured steadfastly like someone who has gazed on the invisible one. I want to talk about this. some great words in there. He put Egypt behind him. The language for forsook means once and for all, put it behind you. First time he did it. And he didn't, and he left in fear. And the second time he didn't. You know, to be fair, I could understand why he would be afraid of riling the most powerful ruler with the most powerful army on the face of the earth. There would have been something to be scared of. So why wasn't he? The answer is right here. And I didn't see it. Oh, for many years, I didn't see it. It was by faith that he forsook Egypt. He left it behind because he trusted God. He trusted that he was doing what God wanted him to do. But if you follow the sentence structure, it was by faith that he was not fearing the wrath of the king. And it was by faith that he endured. So it was faith that motivated him for all of that. What could make somebody, this is not a guy who's naive about the power of Egypt. This is a guy who used to be the commander of the Egyptian forces, who knows the politics and the dynamics of power struggles within Egypt better than anybody. Why was he not afraid of what the king could throw at him? The answer is really simple, and it'll set us free. He just saw God as bigger than Pharaoh. So no contest. And it was by trusting in God that he didn't fear the wrath of the king. I'll spend the rest of our time, I think I've got about 15 minutes. And I love talking about this, and we'll pick up next week with some of the interesting episodes of faith in the journey that Moses led the children of Israel, as technically God led them, and they followed. But I want to look at this phrase, he endured. It's a strong word. The Greek word is the word kartereo, K-A-R-T-E-R-E-O. If you recognize the word tereo in there, it's because it is a compound word. And I love, the Amplified Bible nails the flavor of it when it says, he never flinched, he held staunchly to his purpose, and he endured steadfastly. It's a very rare word to be translated endured. There are other more common words. But it speaks of having a firm grip on something enough to hang in there. What did he endure? Well, he endured 14,400 days of bellyaching people who fought him every step of the way across hostile conditions, having to live every step of it, every day of it, by faith. And the way he was able to do it is that he was able to fix his eyes on the invisible one. The language is really clear. That's how he could do it. This is what pulled me out of my depression over how in the world, you know, is the church going to survive and how am I going to survive and blah, blah, blah. And when I looked up some figures, it was astonishing to me. At the time that Moses took off with the children of Israel, there were 2.5 million people, approximately, could have been more, could have been a little bit less, plus their livestock. It would have taken 11 million gallons of water a day just to provide basic. We're not talking about swimming pools and, you know, long hot showers. We're talking about just the basic requirements for survival for that many people and animals, 11 million gallons. One commentator that loves such things painted a picture. He says it's 1,500 railroad tanker cars of water every day. Did they have to carry it with them? Well, no, they didn't, because sometimes they were camped by a river. Sometimes God brought it out of a rock. But that's an enormous amount of water. Plus, their clothes didn't wear out. Their shoes didn't wear out for 14,400 days. How much food would they have to carry? Well, they could eat some of the animals. That's why they took some of the animals. But it would still take, and I've read estimates of between 1,500 tons to 2,500 tons. So between 3 million and 5 million pounds of food every day. Now, we know that some of the food that they had after they ran out of everything else was manna. I don't know why. I just thought of little sprinkly little flakes all over. But when you talk about 5 million pounds worth of manna distributed every day out of nothing. So here's what I'm thinking. Oh, God, I just don't know how you're going to be able to take care of us. God, on paper, it just doesn't work. And God just says, hey, I fed 2.5 million people every single day. I gave them water out of nothing. In the worst, most inhospitable conditions that anybody could be in. And I did it all by myself. So, son, I can take care of you. So that's part of what it teaches me about trusting God. Moses had to trust God every single day with those logistical realities. I don't know if you've ever had, well, of course you haven't. None of us have ever had that kind of a demand. But just do the math. It'll help you. Okay. If God can do that for 2.5 million people in the middle of the wilderness, can he do it for 50 people in a land that's at least got an economy that's not dead? Can he do it? Of course he can. It's not a contest for him. I don't know how he's going to do it. But if there's anything we learn about trusting God through the wilderness, was you didn't have to figure out how he was going to do it. He just did it out of nothing. In fact, that's what the whole word manna means. What's this? Because no one had ever seen it before. He just made out of nothing. And of course, they bellyached and they complained. And I have to tell you, this was an encouraging study for me in ministry, because my job's way easier than Moses' job. Yeah, I do have people that get mad at me. I have had ever since I've been here. People that you tell them the truth and they want to punch your lights out, or people that just don't like the way you do things. But these people nagged at Moses and falsely accused him, didn't believe what he said, and all he was trying to do was obey God, and God wanted to bless the people. Talk about being misunderstood. So I love this phrase. He never flinched, held staunchly to his purpose, and endured steadfastly like someone who is seeing the invisible one. I just love that wording. It reminds me of a scripture. It reminds me of a scripture that's on your license plate, Carol, from 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18 says this, and it's written to people who are facing hardship, who are facing instability in their world, and it tells them how they cope. Here's what Paul says. We fix our eyes not on the things that are seen, but on the things that are unseen. Because the things that are visible are temporary, and the things that are invisible are deathless and everlasting. It's all a matter of perspective. It's all a matter of focus. Moses had greater demands than we do. He made harder choices than we do. He had a long obedience in the same direction under very demanding, stressful circumstances. He probably leads the pack, I would think. But it tells us the way he did it is that he trusted God. He did have to alter his perspective. He had to see God as bigger than Pharaoh so he wouldn't be afraid. He had to see God as his provider, even though by all human calculations, in fact, it's kind of hilarious. If you just go online and hear all the things people criticize about the whole Exodus story, and all of them talk about, you know, it's just impossible. It would take a miracle. And I want to go, what's your point? The Bible's very straightforward about, yes, it did take a miracle. That's the point. And of course, if you don't want to believe that there's a God, then it's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. It's so far beyond laughable. You'd be an idiot to believe it. One guy believed it enough to stick his neck out for 14,400 days and go out there. He believed it enough to leave behind pleasure that he had experienced, the best that the world could offer, and to choose to identify with the despised, enslaved people who didn't even appreciate what he was doing for him. He counted it out and decided it was worth it. What's the obvious lesson in this? Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 tells us that this story was told to us so that we could look at this example and run our race and make our choice and make our calculated decisions. Now, I mean, I look at this and I find it very convicting because as hard as my life has been, and it's been the hardest it's ever been in this last 10 years, in every way, physically, pain, years worth of constant headaches, losing people I love, losing people from the church, being falsely accused, and I mean, just everything you think of, a huge financial loss. But I have been greatly encouraged by looking, and that's why I love Hebrews chapter 11. I'll read through it and I say, you know what? There are people that made harder choices and suffered greater pain and greater deprivation than me. And they did it for the same reason I'm doing what I'm doing. We have decided to follow Jesus. We've made a choice. And making the choice means we refuse one thing and we embrace another thing. I truly do not believe that somebody's a Christian if they have not done that. That's my opinion. If there's not a leaving behind and an embracing the Lord, then it's just semantics to me. It's not really being a Christian. It's for sure not being a disciple. Because Jesus said that the disciple is the one that denies himself, his self-life, and takes up whatever cross it is that puts his flesh to death and follows Jesus. I just find this tremendously encouraging. Don't you find it encouraging that for a minimal amount of input and absolutely no advantages, for a few years, enough truth was planted in Moses' heart that when he was tempted with the very best sin the world had to offer, he counted it all out and made the choice to turn down that and to embrace God's plan. And after failing, and after feeling like a failure for 40 stinking years, he was willing to be convinced to disrupt his life and spend another 40 years completely out of his comfort zone. It is interesting that he was more prepared than he thought he was for taking those people across the wilderness. 40 years taking care of sheep in the wilderness is not wasted time. The Bible says in one place, I said this last night and I find it intriguing, the Bible says that Moses was the humblest man that ever lived. But he wasn't always that way, was he? No, he wasn't. He was Mr. Fix-It. I'm the perfect guy to set my people free. Look at all the power. Look at all the privilege I have. And when he stepped out, he had the right idea. He just did it the wrong way. Got everybody mad at him. I just find the story so encouraging, and there's some on so many levels. I wish every parent in our church could hear this, because what the world says is you're wasting your time. You're throwing your life away. Spend your time with your kids. Every Sunday school teacher should hear this. It doesn't matter that you're telling these kids the truth. Yeah, it's life or death. It's eternity at stake. It breaks my heart when I look at you. We have hardly any of our youth group are even attempting to walk with Jesus right now. Very few, one or two. But you know what? The story's not over. And I found myself being greatly encouraged, saying, what if it doesn't kick in until they're 40? And what if there's 28 years of, like the prodigal, wasting everything, coming to an end of themselves. That was part of the point of Jesus' story. The prodigal did come to his senses. It's a similar idea in a way, if you want to think about it, as the calculations that Moses made. Prodigal wastes it all, does everything that he could afford to do, and his then conclusion, he's eating pig food, and he says, you know, it really wasn't so bad at my dad's house, and I think I'll humble myself, and I'll go back there, and I'll just be a servant because it's better than what I have here. So now we know what to pray for, don't we? Let's pray. Thank you, Lord, for this study. Thank you for how it encouraged me. Thank you for the math of it. Thank you for the just completely unearthly logic of it. Thank you for the way that you showed that you are able to fulfill your plans for the people that you have marked for your purposes. You're able to do it despite all that the world throws at them. You're able to do it all by yourself. All you're looking for is a few people that will believe that and step out on it and obey and trust you. I want to be one of those people, Lord. I want all my friends to be people like that. So, Lord, my prayer is there's just a handful hearing these words in this room, but I pray that many people will hear this and that it will challenge them and encourage them and do what it was preserved to do in this book. It will enable us to fix our eyes in the appropriate place so that we can finish the race that's marked out for us individually. And I'm praying that, Lord, knowing that your word never returns fruitless. I'm counting on that. Bless the website, Lord. Bless the CDs. Bless the ones that get passed around. Bless our lives with the challenge of this so that it affects other people. All of this we pray that you would be glorified in us. Amen.